If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
When you think of Jimmy Carter today, you think of the Nobel Prize-winning Habitat for Humanity house-building ex-president who champions human rights around the world. But back in the late 70s, it was a different story. We'll talk about all of it next. President Jimmy Carter tonight on the Friday Night Show.
With a degree in nuclear engineering from Annapolis and his new bride, Rosalyn, Jimmy Carter began his Navy career working on a nuclear sub in New York State. But his father's death in 1953 brought him back to Plains, Georgia, to run the family peanut business. The confident, hard-working Carter soon entered local and state politics. Following an unsuccessful run for governor in 66, he tried again and won in 1970. When he announced his presidential candidacy in 74, the reaction of most Americans was, "Jimmy who?" But his energetic campaigning, emphasis on human rights, and the country's desire to bring dignity back to the White House after the Watergate era helped Jimmy Carter win his party's nomination and then the election of 76.
Through 22 months, and I didn't get choked up until I...
The high point of his White House years was the Camp David Middle East Peace Accord. His most stressful time came during the Iran hostage crisis. At home, gas lines and soaring inflation would be prime factors dooming his bid for re-election. After Ronald Reagan defeated him, Carter, only 56, seemed adrift. But soon he began working on his Carter Center in Atlanta, a nonprofit organization that prevents and resolves conflicts, alleviates suffering, and monitors elections worldwide. Jimmy Carter has written 20 books. His most recent is Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis.
Pleasure to have you here, Mr. President.
Yes, nice to be with you. Thank you.
And a belated happy birthday, October 1st, 81, right?
81, right. Yes, still surviving.
I like what you wrote in your book about 6 or 7 years ago, The Virtues of Aging. And you said, each of us is old when we think we are, and it's not tied very closely to how many years we've lived.
Well, I still believe that.
I hope so.
Even more intensely now than I did 6 years ago.
Before we get to your book, Our Endangered Values, you were the last president that Mayor Richard J. Daley campaigned for.
Exactly.
And I know he withheld his support for a bit, but what do you remember about your dealings with Mayor Daley and your time in Chicago? I know you came to the funeral mass as president-elect in 76.
Well, he was a personal friend. When he was ill toward the end of his days, I arranged for him to come down to Georgia on vacation. And then when I ran for president, he had a favorite son here, as you remember, Senator Adlai Stevenson, Jr. And Mayor Daley tried to help him all he could. I still got two-thirds of the votes, but he took it very graciously. And toward the end of a campaign, he told me that if I carried Ohio on the last day of a campaign, that he would deliver all of the delegates that Adlai Stevenson had gotten, which gave me 100% of the Illinois delegates. And that put me over the top. So then I had a clear majority when we went to the Democratic Convention.
Didn't he want to have Stevenson on the ticket as vice president?
He didn't ever push that, no. In fact, I really interviewed six people as potential vice presidents, and Adlai Stevenson was not one of them. And I don't remember that Mayor Daley particularly wanted that.
You have a reputation as a politician who always saw personal politics as a bit of a nuisance. And I think Tip O'Neill once said that you never understood how the system worked. What I wonder about with you and the whole deal-making game in Washington is, looking at your career, you've mastered everything you wanted to master: school, the Navy, business, getting elected to the White House. Why isn't it that you didn't seem to want to master that game, or is that a fair assessment?
I never have been successful in being a party functionary or party person. I did much better when I was campaigning as a lonely
Outsider.
He was a peanut farmer, kind of outsider. Mm-hmm. And then when I got the nomination, I kind of felt that the Democratic Party was a burden for me rather than an asset. And I really failed in some ways to marshal the Democratic Party as a coherent support for me when I ran for re-election. As you may remember, Ted Kennedy, a couple of years before I went out of office, was determined that he was going to take over as a Democratic nominee in 1980. And he campaigned against me aggressively in 1979 and 80. I beat him 2-1. But at the end of the campaign and after the Democratic Convention of 1980, the Kennedy wing of the Democratic Party never did support me. And that's one of the reasons that I failed to get reelected. The other one, as you mentioned on the program a little bit earlier, I saw, was the hostages, all of whom came home safe and free about 5 minutes after I was out of office. I had spent 3 days negotiating their release. And, of course, Iraq invaded Iran and cut off all the oil supplies from those two countries, which created worldwide inflation. So, you know, there were multiple factors involved in 1980.
In the book, America's Moral Crisis, Our Endangered Values, you write about a theme involving the wall between church and state being broken down.
Right.
And the fundamentalist approach to politics and policies, one that's rigid, intolerant, exclusionary. What part has 9/11 and the terrorist attacks that we see around the world now played in shaping all of that and shaping who we are today?
Well, beginning about 25 years ago, fundamentalism in American religion began to become evident. And now that has become a major factor in some of the religious circles. And at the same time, there's been an element of fundamentalism, or what some people might call neoconservatism, whatever, in political circles. And in the last 5 years, under this new administration, the two have merged, which in my opinion is one of the dramatic changes, profound and significant changes, that's taken place in politics, and one of the reasons I wrote this book. But with that merger of the two, that has resulted in many significant modifications in the ancient values that have guided our country since its very founding, in my opinion. For instance, I don't think there's any doubt that long before George Bush was elected president, certainly before 9/11, there was a decision made by some of the key leaders in our Washington now, we will go to war against Iraq. It wasn't something that happened after 9/11. And so they were looking for reasons to go to war. So we've now got dramatic new policies in the basic structure of government, not between Democrats and Republicans, but comparing this administration with all the previous presidents down through history, including the presidencies of George Bush Sr., or of Ronald Reagan, or Gerald Ford, or Eisenhower, mm-hmm. as well as Democratic presidents. And they involve not only the merger of church and state, which, as you know, Thomas Jefferson said, build a wall between the two. But we have a new policy on peace now, or war. We've in the past always said we will go to war reluctantly when our danger is directly threatened. Now we have a new policy publicly announced, preemptive war. We'll go to war against another country. We'll bomb them. We'll drop bombs or missiles on them. We'll invade the country if we think that the leader is so obnoxious that we need to remove him from office, or if we think that someday in the distant future our security might be threatened. That's a radical departure in policy. Another thing that concerns me that's been in the news more lately is that we have always been the champion of human rights. One vivid example under debate is whether the United States of America should condone the torture of prisoners. As you know, during the Second World War, Hitler abused the Jews horribly in the Holocaust. And I lost my favorite uncle, Tom Gordy, who was a Navy petty officer on Guam. He was captured by the Japanese 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. He was tortured for 4 years. When he got out of prison at the end of the war, he only weighed 85 pounds. He had to go to the hospital for months to recover. Because of those abuses of human rights, America went to Geneva And we negotiated what's called the Geneva Accords, which says no matter how obnoxious, you know, prisoners might have been against your country, we don't torture them. Mm-hmm. Now, the vice president is openly encouraging the members of the Congress to approve torture by the CIA. And we now have found out last week that they have dozens of secret dark holes, they call them, around the world. Another very dramatic change that concerns me very much is in the environment. We've always been in the forefront of protecting air and water pollution challenges and protecting natural areas. That's been changed dramatically in the last 5 years as well. One of the big arguments today in the news media is concerning oil drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Region. This was not a Democratic commitment. It was a commitment made by Dwight Eisenhower, who said this particular pristine area should be preserved forever. Now, this administration is trying to break that down. So you see, there's a lot of basic changes that I describe in this book that I think far transcend just the fundamentalism or just the merger of church and state. I think it goes much deeper than that.
You say it's not a Democratic or a Republican statement you're making.
Right.
And it's true, although in part it certainly attacks much of the policy by this administration.
I agree.
And you've had cordial relations with the current president. Will you still after this book?
I hope so. You know, I've been to the White House a number of times, twice this year. We monitored the election in Palestine in January, when Mahmoud Abbas was elected, Abu Mazen. And when I got back from there, President Bush invited me to the White House to explain what I thought about the future Middle East peace process. And then more recently, James Baker and I, former Secretary of State under George Bush Sr., was my partner in evolving a set of recommendations on how to improve further the U.S. election procedures. And so we went to the White House to give our presentation. So, in the past, we've had a good relationship, and I'm very careful in this book not to criticize, you know, President Bush personally or anything. I think that just the policies that have been adopted are so radical and so different from past mm-hmm. that I think that somebody needs to speak out and let it be a subject of public debate.
You're very good in the book about expressing your openness to other views every couple of chapters. And it's interesting hearing about your upbringing and your father, who was very tough by all accounts. You said that as a kid, even if you did what he wanted to do, he would never say, "Good job, Jimmy." You never got that from him. So where does your sensitivity to other people come from? And what were the good qualities from your dad you did get? And I imagine your mom being on the board of everything and serving all kinds of people all the time gave you a lot of that spirit.
I think my mother was the most vivid influence in that particular respect. I appreciate the compliment. I don't claim that I deserve it. But my mother was a registered nurse, and we lived in a completely segregated southern community then. Mother never paid any attention to racial distinctions. She was one of the few who didn't at that time, and she got away with it because she represented the medical community, and so she nursed our neighbors, all of whom happened to be African American. We didn't have any white neighbors. And then mother, when she was almost 70 years old, joined the Peace Corps and went to India for 2.5 years. And she served there, came back as what you would ordinarily consider an old person. She made 500 speeches after she came back, telling people, you know, you're never too old to take on a new career, to do something exciting and challenging and unpredictable and adventurous. And so my mother, I think, was one that convinced me that you shouldn't have distinctions among people. And I think that's one of the things that also I and many other people who are Christians or not believe is an element of faith.
When you came back to Plains after your dad died, I know you got a new picture of your father, didn't you, when you saw the people who came to pay condolence calls. What changed?
I had left home when I was quite young. I finished high school. I was not quite 16 years old. I went off to Georgia Tech and then to the U.S. Navy. I served in the Navy 11 years. And I was still in the Navy working under Admiral Hyman Rickover in charge of the second atomic submarine crew. I was a senior officer there, the Seawolf. And when my daddy was on his deathbed, I got permission from Admiral Rickover to go home and take care of things for a couple of weeks. And I saw, in a personal and surprising way, how my daddy's life in that little tiny town, we have now grown to 635, positively affected the lives of so many people. And he did it secretly. And there were many people who came to our house, black and white people, and Daddy was not able to see anybody. He was almost on the verge of death. And they would tell me, just tell Mr. Earl how much he's changed our life and thank him for the things he's done. And I found out, as executive of his estate, that he had been amazingly generous to people, almost always without my mother even knowing what he had done. So it was because of that experience that I decided to get out of the Navy and take a chance and go back to Plains and start a new career, which amazed and aggravated my wife incredibly. We drove all the way from Schenectady to New York, where we were building this submarine nuclear plant, to Plains, 700 miles. She never spoke to me all the way down. And it took her a little while to get over it. So that was a transformation in my life, which I thought at first was going to be a real serious setback. We didn't have any money. We stayed in the government housing program, a project. We got by with $31 a month rent. The first year I was home, the entire year, we made less than $300 total income for a whole year. And out of that grew good peanuts and corn and cotton and made a living.
That's a tough time. And after 60 years of marriage, do you still rank that as your number one argument? When you had to come back?
That's been the most serious argument.
Yeah.
Because Rosalind really loved the Navy. I did too. And I couldn't explain to her adequately, and still it's hard for me to explain, why I abandoned what I considered to be the top job in the Navy for someone my rank. I was in charge of one of the two nuclear submarines, the first time peaceful power had ever been used for, nuclear power had been used for peaceful purposes, and I gave it all up.
It worked out.
It worked out okay.
How come you've never gone on the very lucrative speaking circuit as other ex-presidents have? You've never done that.
No, I haven't. And I don't ever intend to. I don't criticize anybody else. I'm not saying that. But you know, Harry Truman kind of set a pattern. He's been my favorite hero in politics in my lifetime. And he went back to a modest career back in his home. So I never have served on corporate boards, and I never have been on the speaking circuit. But I have a very good income. We have retirement from the White House, and also I'm a full-time I'm a professor at Emory University. It's my 24th year. But most of our income has been from my books.
You still teach in Sunday school in Plains?
Every Sunday that I'm home, about 35 to 40 times a year.
And I imagine all the visitors who come from all over to hear you, you probably have more people in the church than population of Plains some Sundays.
Sometimes we do. We have about 30 or 40 of our own church members here. That's a small church. But we have from, I'd say, 300 to 800 visitors who come every Sunday to see a curiosity of a politician teaching the Bible. One Sunday we had visitors there from 28 foreign countries. Only about 15% of the visitors are of Baptists, my fellow Baptists. Others are Protestant denominations, Catholics, and we have a lot of a good many Jews come, and we have Muslims, Hindus come from foreign countries primarily, just to participate in a general discussion about religious ethics and principles and moral values.
And that may be the only thing that Rosalind is not your partner in, teaching Sunday school. She's your partner in everything, isn't she?
Yes, she is. Rosalind is a preeminent leader in the world on the promotion of mental health and trying to decrease the stigma that families feel when someone has a mental problem. And she has an organization of women leaders, including first ladies, a few queens, and some prime ministers and others who are women. And they try to promote mental health care. So, and Rosen's an equal partner with me in all of our work at the Carter Center.
You know, you may want to do a marriage manual for your next book.
Well, I wrote a book not too long ago called Sharing Good Times that really spells out the intimate relationship that I have with Rosen and how many things we do as partners. Sometimes she initiates some, something and that I haven't done before, and vice versa. So we've kind of learned to do everything as we can together. So we try nowadays, not earlier, we didn't, weren't successful to not ever go to bed angry. We have that as a commitment, and we give each other plenty of space. We don't try to dominate each other. Although I was kind of dominant early in my life, she soon overcame.
Well, you're that, a military guy. You're Mr. Navy man.
Well, Rosen put a stop to that, and it's been a good thing for both of us.
I know during your presidency, you would have a meeting, and then into a tape recorder, you would dictate some notes to yourself,
yes,
things that wouldn't be on the public record, and then had them transcribed. In your memoirs, did we get everything that there was to get,
no,
or is there going to be more?
Well, someday I think I'm going to authorize my entire memoirs to be published. There are 6,000 pages of typewritten notes. But many of my comments then still apply to people in public life. And it wouldn't be appropriate for me to make those unvarnished statements public. But when I wrote Keeping Faith, which was a memoir of my presidency, I read those notes for the first time, and I extracted from them the key elements that describe what happened to me and why I did certain things as president of this great country.
So many people admire you and your work. Who do you admire? Not just world leaders, but people you look up to, people we should listen to, people we should follow.
Well, I think in political circles, Billy Graham, I think, to me, epitomizes what a religious leader used to be. And should be. He's a Christian, obviously, unadorned. But he considers everybody to be the same value in the eyes of God. He doesn't have the exclusive and dominating elements of fundamentalism, which I think is a real challenge. Just 2 days ago, I was with the Dalai Lama, for instance, in a forum in San Francisco, and he and I answered questions about the threats to world peace and world justice and the need for benevolence and forgiveness. So he's another leader that's not a Christian that I happen to admire. And there are a number of other leaders around the world who are very admirable in their commitments. Some presidents, for instance, of African countries who have espoused democracy and freedom and human rights in their own countries at tremendous danger to themselves. We just helped with the conduct of the election in Liberia, which happens to be over, by the way, with the election yesterday. And my wife and I were there, and that was the 61st election that we have monitored to try to bring democracy to people. So those kind of heroes around the world are very admirable to me.
And you go where the United States government does not, correct?
That's correct. Well, when a small country has a serious problem with peace, say they have an ongoing civil war or a threatened civil war, or when they have a totalitarian or authoritarian government and they want to try democracy for the first time, or have a democracy that's fragile and maybe in danger, the last thing they want is for the United Nations to come in or for the United States to come in. So since we're already in the country, with the Carter Center's work, teaching them how to grow more corn or wheat or rice or sorghum or millet or eradicating diseases and so forth, they turn to us to help them with those kinds of things. So that's where most of our effort is expended these days.
And how is your family? How are the kids? How is little Amy?
Well, little 9-year-old Amy now has a 6-year-old son.
Yeah, there you go.
Our youngest grandson, whose name is Hugo, well above average child. We have three other children, all boys, not very well known. In all, we have 11 grandchildren, and so far, all of our family is doing well.
And there may be another Carter coming up in the political ranks, I hear, in Nevada, right?
Yes, our oldest son, Jack, who is actually a nuclear physicist, he graduated from Georgia Tech in nuclear physics and went to law school, and then he was in Chicago and lived here a long time, working in the Chicago Board of Trade. Now he's an investment banker, and he's been living out in Nevada for a number of years. And the Democrats out there have been very eager to see him run for office. So he's seriously considering running for the U.S. Senate.
The book is Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis. And it's a book that you read it, and then don't put it away on the shelf just yet. Keep it on the table, because you tend to keep going back and looking at things again and thinking about things. And it does open up discussion and debate, doesn't it?
I hope so. This is not a book that's personally critical against anyone, as you noticed. You've already read it. It's a book that's supposed to precipitate debates in this country. Mm-hmm. And to show, in my opinion, that we've had a trend away from the basic values that have shaped the character of our country. And I don't think yet that the majority of American people have adopted these new policies. I think it's up for grabs, in effect. And so that's why the book is written, is to precipitate open discussion on some very, very controversial things, as you know.
Well, Mr. President, great to be with you. Thanks for being our guest tonight.
It's a real pleasure.
All the best, health and happiness to you and the family. By the way, you still throwing the softball around at all?
Yeah, I pitched last month in Plains. I'm still a pitcher on our softball team.
And that's 12-inch, right? That's here's the Chicago softball, the 16-inch.
We use the 12-inch. This is a good softball, but we use it the 12-inch size. I used to pitch baseball when I was younger. But now I pitch softball.
Yeah, and your mom was a big fan of the Atlanta Crackers?
No, my mother was a Dodger fan.
Oh, really?
In fact, she would go to the Atlanta Braves box and sit with Ted Turner, the owner, and scream in a horrendous voice that you could hear all over the stadium for the Dodgers. So she was an avid Dodger fan. And our whole family has been deeply immersed in baseball, and I want to congratulate the Chicago folks who saw the White Sox win this year. I was very proud of them.
How about that?
And that was a great victory for people that love baseball.
And leave your mitt at home and walk around with that ball, and you're an honorary Chicagoan.
All right.
This country is very fortunate to have somebody like you representing us around the world. Hope to see you again soon.
I hope so, too.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for letting me come.
And that's it for the Friday Night Show. We'll be back Monday night live at 7 on Chicago Tonight. Until then, for all of us on The Late Shift here at Channel 11, thank you for watching. Have a great weekend.